And if we're not careful, one of the things that can happen to us is we can get to thinking that we're just entitled. We're just entitled to certain things, that I deserve certain things. It's what we call the American dream, that people just get used to thinking that there's just certain things that just are supposed to always be. I am entitled to a life of happiness. After all, doesn't it say that this is all about life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness? I deserve to be happy. I'm entitled to a carefree life with all the pleasurable things that money can buy. A nice car, a nice home, play toys that I enjoy, and some of the best food that you could ever eat in all your life. I deserve that. And I might say that I'm a bit worried about kids who grow up in that society, and I often think about what it would be like if they had to go back and do things like a lot of you older people have had to do. I can remember seeing a spool of thread where they'd take the old wooden spool years ago and make a toy out of that. Also at home, we've got a little place in front of our couch where we store some things. It's a kind of a shadow box kind of thing. And in that box, there's a little ceramic little boy. And that little boy is the only toy that Susan's father can remember ever having. And we're thrilled to be able to have that and look at that and think about that. And just think about all he's got to play with is that little ceramic boy. That's all he had. And yet, it seems to me that today there's kids who'll get upset and pitch fit, if you will, because they want to go buy the next Nintendo game that's come out, and I've just got to have that right now. I mean, I deserve that. And so I think that if we're not careful, we live in a society where we just come to expect that certain things are just going to always be there. We truly live in a land that flows with milk and honey, but I fear that what that has done is it has produced a lot of spoiled people, including myself. You may remember this portrait. It's been around for years and years. It's referred to as a portrait that is referred to as American Gothic. And when I was preparing for this sermon, I found a more modern version of this man and this woman. And this is what they would look like today with their golf clubs and their cell phones and their latte and the limousine back in the back waiting to carry them somewhere. Society has changed a great deal. And there is no doubt that this has spilled over into Christianity. Things like preachers on TV who preach a health and wealth gospel, that if you'll become a Christian, that God will bless your life and Jesus will bless your life and you'll have all kinds of health and wealth. God will make you rich. And that's preached in a whole lot of places. Also, you see various occasions where Christians go through a midlife crisis where they just, after a while, is this all there is? I remember one guy calling me who had decided that he was just going to live it up, that he was tired of living the life that he was living, and he just wanted to go out there and enjoy all the things that were out there to enjoy. And basically his message was to me, I'm going to go out and have some fun. And my response to him was, is you better have all the fun you can, because you're not going to have any when this life is over. The good news to that is that he one time later came back to the Lord. And he laughs about that today, not about what he did, but he laughs about the comment that I made about you better have all the fun you can. But there's this mentality of I just deserve this. And there's songs that have to do with this midlife thing. I've raised my children, I've done my job, and now I'm going to live my life. And I can't tell you the number of times when I have talked to people and maybe they're in a divorce situation and they know good and well that they do not have any right to remarry. And the common statement that you hear is, well, wouldn't God want me to be happy? As though that's just the main thing. I'm just supposed to always be happy. Wouldn't God want me to be happy? And my response to that has always been, God wants you to be holy. God wants you to be holy. And if holiness makes you happy, then so be it. But God is not after our earthly happiness per se. It has become norm for so many people to have these great expectations. And what's remarkable about that is that we get to thinking that these things are the things that we are entitled to. And yet when you read your Bible, you find out that so many of the things that we think we are entitled to are the very things that God warns us about. And actually says that those things can actually be dangerous for you. And so it's kind of like God flips the tables on that. And a lot of it has to do with where we keep these things in our perspective. First of all, there's the matter of money. 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 10 has that famous verse that we've known all of our lives, where Paul says in 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 10, "For the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil, for which some have strayed from the faith in their greediness, and they have pierced themselves through with many sorrows." The love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. See the warnings that God is giving about that? And then in Luke chapter 12 and verse 15, you remember the story of the rich man who was going to tear down his barns and build bigger barns and so forth. And Jesus said, "Take heed and beware of covetousness, for a man's life does not consist in the abundance of things that he possesses." That life is more than money. And you need to take heed and you need to beware of it, because life is not about that. And yet, it's the very thing that we come to crave and love, and everything has to be fed by that. It's about my status and who I am. And again, there's just a huge push in that. And yet God is warning about the love, not money, but the love of money. And then there's that nice big house. I've always loved Proverbs chapter 15 and verse 16. Proverbs chapter 15 and verse 16, where the Bible just simply says, Better is a little with the fear of the Lord than great treasure with trouble. I've seen it happen a number of times where someone has so much and yet they're absolutely miserable. I'm thinking of a man one time that was going through a nasty, terrible divorce. His whole world was falling apart. He lived in a gated community. I could not get to his house without passing through a gate that's guarded. Fabulous things, and all of that was wonderful, and I was glad for him to have it. And it wasn't wrong for him to have it. But he buried his face in a napkin and cried his eyes out, because he realized indeed that better is a little with the fear of the Lord than great treasure with trouble. He had him some trouble. He had him some great treasure, but it could not scratch the itch. And so again, the things that mean so much and we feel like we're entitled to, God actually warns about them. And then there's the matter of education. In 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 21, God even warns about that too. That you can get so much worldly wisdom that you lose your common sense. And I've seen that happen too. Where people can no longer listen to the simple things of the Bible, and that just settled the matter. Because they're just smarter than that. They've learned better than that in their mind. And God warns about that. He warns about the dangers of all of that education. Again, not wrong to have it, but we've got to realize where things are. I remember one time in Gardendale, there was a guy who got up and preached or did a Wednesday night invitation. I never will forget him. His name was Jeff Gray, great friend of mine, doing very well. And he was in computer science. And I want to tell you, the guy had a head on him. He was as smart as he could be. And I never will forget, he said, "I rub shoulders with people who have PhDs every single day." He said, "They are so stinking smart." He was one too. He's actually Dr. Jeff Gray. But what he ended up saying was, he said, "But when I need advice and counsel on what really matters, I don't go to them. They have nothing to offer." He said, "I go to my granddaddy and grandmama's place out on the farm. And I talk to them about life. And I talk to them about my problems. I talk to them about what I'm going through. And they give me stuff that really, really, really is helpful." 1 Corinthians 1 and verse 21, Paul says, "In the wisdom of God, the world through wisdom did not know God. It pleased God through the foolishness of the message preached to save those who believe." The world in its wisdom doesn't know God, and that's exactly the danger of it. And so again, we're seeing the things that mean so much to us become the very things that God warns us about. Now let me ask this question. If we are so entitled to the life that we think we deserve, then how do you explain these people? Joseph, one bad thing after another. It gets worse and worse and worse. And even in prison, he finally sees an opportunity to maybe get out of here. He tells the butler, when you go back to Pharaoh, remember me. And guess what? He forgot him. And he spends 2 more years in prison. One terrible thing after another. Look at what is said about it in Genesis 47 and verse 9. In Genesis 47 and verse 9, this is the way it is summed up. Jacob says to Pharaoh when he finally makes his way to Egypt, he said, the days of the years of my pilgrimage are 130 years. Few and evil have been the days of the years of my life, and they have not attained to the days of the years of the life of my fathers in the days of their pilgrimage. Basically, he says, I've been a pilgrim for 130 years. My days have been few and evil. All of them. Joseph, one problem after another. Wasn't he entitled to a trouble-free life? And then there's Moses. Moses has to lead the children of Israel from Egypt to the promised land. And he gets so stressed out. You want to see some major stress levels as he's trying to lead the people of God, and they're complaining and they're murmuring. And he finally says to God in Numbers 11 and verse 11, Moses said to the Lord, why have you afflicted your servant? Why have I not found favor in your sight that you've laid the burden of all these people on me? Did I conceive all these people? Did I beget them that you should say to me, carry them in your bosom as a guardian carries a nursing child to the land which you swore to their fathers? Where am I to get meat, God, for all these people? They weep all over me, saying, give us meat that we may eat. See, they felt entitled. We deserve the way we had it in Egypt. And he says, I am not able to bear all these people alone because the burden is too heavy for me. And notice this. He says, if you treat me like this, just kill me right here and now. I've been stressed before, but I've never asked God to kill me. Moses was that stressed. Just kill me right here and now. If I found favor in your sight, and do not let me see my wretchedness. I know he's speaking out of a heart that's just full, but still, did Moses not deserve better than that? Did he really have to put up with that? Did he have to have a church that didn't have problems? You know, that it's called the church in the wilderness in Acts chapter 7. There's a sense in which it was a church in that it was a called out group of people to God. Was he entitled to one that didn't have problems? He seemed to think so, but it doesn't look like that's the case with God. If we're so entitled, what about Naomi? My Bible reading now is in Ruth, and I got a chance to see this again. But turn to Ruth, and you may remember that Naomi comes back to her homeland. She had left it because of a famine. She goes to the land of Moab with her husband, and while she's in the land of Moab, she loses her husband, and she loses two of her boys, and she's left with only her daughters-in-law. And she begs them not to go with her back to the land. She's heard that things are better there, and she's going to go back. But I want you to notice when she goes back what is said. In the book of Ruth, chapter 1, verse 20, beginning. They said in the last part of verse 19, is this Naomi? And she said, do not call me Naomi. Call me Mara. The word Mara means bitter. You may remember there was a place where God made some bitter water sweet. That place was called Mara. She said, don't call me Naomi, just call me Mara. She said, because the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. Now, I don't know if she's trying to speak in a complaint, or she's just saying, this is just the facts. He's just dealt bitterly with me. She said, I went out full, and the Lord has brought me home again empty. Why do you call me Naomi, since the Lord has testified against me, and the Almighty has afflicted me? She's lost her husband and both her sons. Did she deserve a less bitter life? Was she entitled to it? And then there's King David. He ran from a stalker for more than 10 years of his life. I know that there's a weariness. This started March the 20th or thereabout? A few months. Can you imagine somebody trying to kill you, and you looking over your shoulders wondering if the next step is going to put him right in your presence, and you do that for 10 years. That's exactly what David faced in 1 Samuel 20 and verse 3. 1 Samuel 20 and verse 3. It says, David took an oath again and said, your father certainly knows that I have found favor in your eyes. And he has said, do not let Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved. But truly, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, there is but a step between me and death. He literally feels like all the time that the next step can be death. Was he entitled to better? Was he entitled to a less fearful life? Abigail didn't have too good of a husband. In 1 Samuel 25 and verse 25, you may remember her husband had terribly disrespected David and wouldn't give him any food to eat when he was out there with his servants. He thought, since they were shearing sheep, that surely he'll give me some food if I ask for it. And he basically just totally disrespected David and said, I'm not going to give my bread and my water and my meat to him. Verse 25, Abigail runs out because she knows that David had plans to kill Nabal. And she says in verse 25, please let not my Lord regard this scoundrel Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. And by the way, Nabal means a fool. And she says he's named right. His name fits him. And she says, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. But I, your maidservant, did not see the young men of my Lord whom you sent. And so basically she's saying, David, don't let your anger run away with you. He's a fool. He just is. I'm married to him, and I love him, but he's a fool. And the question is, did she deserve a better husband? Was she entitled to a better husband? I don't know if he'd always been a scoundrel, but was she entitled to better? Wouldn't God want her to be happy? I mean, why not just ditch him and get somebody else, you know, if you're entitled to something better? And then what about this matter, the matter of Job? We all know what he went through. And he makes a statement himself about it in the midst of his troubles, Job 19. And verse 21, that simply he says, have pity on me. Have pity on me, O you my friends, for the hand of God has struck me. Now that was not true. It was really coming more from the devil at God's allowance. But that's how he feels. The hand of God has struck me. Was he entitled to better? Should he have been free from suffering? Then John the Baptist, he was so faithful to God. You think about what he was. We studied that together this afternoon. John the Baptist being the forerunner for Jesus, and yet look at what happened to him. In Mark chapter 6, beginning in verse 24, they have this feast, and Herodias' daughter dances, and the king gets carried away and says, ask and I'll give it to you up to half my kingdom. Verse 24, so she went out and asked her mother, what shall I ask? And she said, the head of John the Baptist. And immediately she came in with haste to the king and answered, I want you to give me at once the head of John the Baptist on a platter. And the king was exceedingly sorry, yet because of the oaths and because of those who sat with him, he did not want to refuse her. And immediately the king sent an executioner and commanded his head to be brought. And he went and he beheaded him in prison, brought his head on a platter and gave it to the girl. And the girl gave it to him, her mother. Do you get more gruesome than that? I mean, here you are, you're having a feast, and they keep bringing one platter after another, and finally they bring one out that's got a man's head on it. And it's the head of John the Baptist. Wasn't he entitled to better than that? Wasn't he more deserving? And then you think about the Apostle Paul in 2 Corinthians chapter 11. 2 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 23. Paul speaks about his life and he says, are they ministers of Christ? He's talking about these false teachers who are trying to discredit him. Are they ministers of Christ? I speak as a fool. I am more, in labors more abundant, in stripes above measure, in prisons more frequently, in deaths more often. From the Jews 5 times received I 40 stripes minus one. 3 times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked. A night and a day I spent in the deep, in journeyings often, in perils of waters, in perils of robbers, in perils of my own countrymen, in perils of the Gentiles, in perils in the city, perils in the wilderness, perils in the sea, perils among false brethren, in weariness and toil and sleeplessness often, in hunger and thirst and in fastings often, in cold and nakedness, and besides the other things that which comes upon me daily, my deep concern for all the churches. Woo! Rough. Didn't he deserve better? In 2 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 7, on top of all that, he says that he had this great revelation where he saw into the third heaven. And he says in verse 7, lest I should be exalted above measure by the abundance of the revelations, a thorn in the flesh was given to me, a messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I should be exalted above measure. And concerning this thing, I pleaded with the Lord 3 times that it might depart from me. I don't know what his thorn in the flesh was, but he didn't like it. And he begged God 3 times, take it away. God, please take it away. Was he not deserving of something far better than that? Do you see the point I'm trying to make is that it's just easy for us to get to thinking that I just deserve a certain lifestyle. I just do. It's the way it is in the red, white, and blue USA. And yet you look at all these people and you go, would they feel sorry for us? And then there's Eunice in Acts 16 and verse 1. She seemingly had no help. She seemingly had no help as she raised her son. No help to train him on spiritual things. Did she deserve better? Acts 16 and verse 1, Paul comes to Derbe and Lystra. And behold, a certain disciple was there named Timothy, the son of a certain Jewish woman who believed, but his father was Greek. In all of this, I raise this question. If we deserve a certain kind of life here, and if we deserve certain things, and it is our right, then did something get short-circuited in the lives of these people? It may be that our thoughts of entitlement come from our culture and not from God. And so it's just an opportunity to say, if others have had life difficulties, and some of it even went for a little while, is there something that gives me a pass on that? It reminds me of a fellow down at Gardendale who had lost his son, teenager, lost his son like that. Good boy, good young man, snuffed out like that in an accident. And I never will forget, he told me, his father did sometime later, he said, you know, Jeff, he said, when all that went down and all that happened, he said, I couldn't do anything but ask God, why me? Why me? He said, and then the thought somehow came to me, why not me? Am I special? Other people have lost their children. Other people have had terrible tragedies. Why not me? What gives me a pass? And I have long remembered that. There's a few lessons from God on this, and here's some things I want us to see. First of all, happiness is not promised at all moments in our lives. Our earthly happiness is not God's aim. All of these people that you just read about, it's pretty obvious that God was not about making sure they always had earthly happiness. Most of them dealt with unhappy things for years, and some of them even for a lifetime. God had something better planned for them that could not be answered by this world. And I think all of us have realized that in the times that we are in. I think most of us would say, if it's going to be like this forever, then Lord, come quickly. I want something better. Happiness is not always his aim, but holiness is His aim. And God sometimes uses unhappy moments to grind out holiness in us. It's not a pursuit of happiness. It is a pursuit of holiness. I want you to notice in 1 Timothy chapter 6, and I make the point sometimes when I'm teaching a Bible class on 1 Timothy chapter 6, that the Christian's always on the run. We're always running from some things, and we're running to other things. And so notice he talks about that in verse 6. Godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain that we can carry nothing out. And having food and clothing, with these we shall be content. But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and snare and into many foolish and harmful lusts that drown men in destruction and perdition. For the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil, for which some have strayed from the faith, and they have pierced themselves through with many sorrows. But notice he says in verse 11, you, O man of God, flee these things. Run. Run from the love of money. Run as hard as you can run from it. And by the way, that's still needed. Run from it. If you know that you have a love for money, run from it. But then he says, oh man of God, flee these things and pursue. Now you're going to run getting after something. I'm running from that. I'm running for this. Pursue righteousness and godliness and faith and love and patience and gentleness and fight the good fight of faith. And lay hold on eternal life. Holiness is always God's aim. And God expects us to be faithful in all our circumstances. Remember what he told Paul? When Paul said, God, please, I pleaded with him three times, and he said, my grace is sufficient for you, and my strength is made perfect in weakness. And Paul said that he had learned from that that when I am weak, then I am strong. What Paul is being told by God is, I'm not going to change your circumstances. I'm trying to change you. And I'm trying to get you to where you understand that I'm all you need. And that my grace is enough to hold you up in the midst of all of that. That's what all of the above people that we just talked about a moment ago did. And it's what people still do. My next few stories are true stories. One of them, I meant to get the book out and find out again if I was remembering it right, but I think I've got it right. I know a true story of a young couple that had a child that was born with some disease where it could do nothing for itself. Did they deserve better? But what did they do? For this child that could do nothing for itself, they took care of him. They took care of him minute by minute, day by day, year after year. If I'm remembering right, I think he died when he was about 29 years old. 29 years of helping a child that can do absolutely nothing. I mean nothing. For himself. And I never will forget the tribute that his older brother wrote about him on the day of his death. And he talked about what a tremendous blessing that child had been in their family. I think about a man who's had a wife that was in an accident and she was left in what we used to call a vegetable state. I don't know if that's politically correct anymore, but it's our term for not being able to do anything. I've told you the story a number of times where he was very successful. He was moving up the ladder. There were more opportunities to move even further up the ladder. But he turned down all of those opportunities so that he might stay home and take care of his wife. And one of his colleagues said to him, I cannot believe somebody would say it, but they basically said to him, what are you doing? What are you doing? She doesn't even know who you are. And his response was, she might not know who I am, but I know who she is. She's the woman that I vowed to love until death parted us. Faithful in your circumstances. The other one I have here is a good-looking wife who had surgery and it changed things. And I can't remember the story on this one completely, but best I remember, it was about a very, very good-looking wife that had a brain tumor kind of a situation. And after surgery, her mouth was left very contorted. For him to kiss his wife, he had to contort his mouth in the same way. I do have down the title of the article. It was called, "Their Kiss Still Works." Faithful in his circumstances. A couple finds out that they are in adultery. Here's a true story. I remember this wife crying because she knew that they were in a situation that was adultery. Their separation would mean that he could not marry again. And she felt so much guilt because of what she had brought him into. And she said of him, she said, "He is a red-blooded American man." She was feeling terrible that he was going to have to live the rest of his life celibate. What do you do? She still is faithful. He's still devoted to her care. But that's what you do. A child's life is snuffed out in an automobile accident. The man I mentioned to you earlier that lost his son as a teenager grieved the loss of that child, but then realized, I've got another child at home and I've got to pour myself into him. That child now preaches the gospel of Jesus Christ. I can't do anything about the fact that I lost my son. I've got to give attention to this son. And both of them are okay. One's in heaven, the other one's preaching the gospel. Everything's okay. Faithful in all circumstances. And then an uncaring husband. I'm thinking of a lady who for years and years and years, her husband wouldn't change, would not have any interest in the gospel. But finally one day something happened and he gave his life to the Lord. And when he sat beside her in worship services, she turned and whispered to him, she said, "I've waited 50 years to have you sitting beside me in worship services." 50 years. Faithful in all situations. In all of this, we can take joy in knowing that God is at work. Can I remind you again, in the times that we're living in, that Romans 8 and verse 28 still holds true. We know that all things work together for good. That did not say everything would be good. It said all things work for good. To those who? To those who love God. And to those who are called according to His purpose. And I've always said that I really believe the good thing that He's looking for is in verse 29. For whom He foreknew, He also predestined to be conformed to the image of His Son. That's what God is doing. All things are going to work together for good to make us more like our Lord. And that's really the attitude we have to take, one step at a time. One day at a time, faithful to the Lord all the time, and just let God do whatever it is that God is doing. You can know that God is at work. I'd like to remind you of the people we talked about earlier. Joseph held a nation together, and he fed the nation of Egypt, and he fed surrounding nations as well. And as you well know, it was from that nation that he took care of Israel that came the Christ. Joseph played a part in developing a nation that produced the Christ. Naomi came home. She brought Ruth back with her. She married Boaz. From Boaz came Obed. From Obed came Jesse. From Jesse came David. And from David came Jesus. John the Baptist paved the way for Jesus. Paul took the gospel to the world. Eunice built a Timothy. And Job still speaks today. I've got a friend who told me not long ago that when his sister was dying and he was trying to comfort her, he said, "Sister, what can I do for you?" And she said, "Brother, tell me about Job. Just tell me about Job." Job's still working today. And then this point, God often rewards now, but He certainly rewards in eternity. I think all of us know the great verse in 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 58 that reminds us, 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 58, Thanks be to God who gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. James mentions how important it is sometimes for us just to have patience. In James chapter 5, beginning in verse 7, listen carefully. This ought to work in an agricultural community. Therefore, be patient, brethren. Be patient until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, waiting patiently for it until it receives the early and the latter rain. You also be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Do not grumble against one another, brethren, lest you be condemned. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. My brethren, take the name of the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord as an example of suffering and patience. Indeed, we count them blessed who endure. You have heard of the perseverance of Job, and you have seen the end intended by the Lord, that the Lord is very compassionate and merciful. Be patient. You've seen the end. The Lord is compassionate and He's merciful, and you can take that to the bank. And then God wants us to see that blessedness is deeper than happiness. I believe that's right. I believe there is something that a true Christian has that's deeper than happiness. It's something that you have deep within that keeps you steady and calm and at peace in unhappy moments. If you ask, are you happy about the circumstances? No, I'm not happy about the circumstances. But the true Christian can say, I have joy. I have peace. All is well. If Jesus comes today, all is well. Christians live with a deep joy that hovers over all our unhappy circumstances. So, you know what we all need to grasp out of this? I have down in my notes here, Mrs. June Alexander, somewhere along the way said to me, it takes a mature faith to understand that life will not always bring happy moments. It takes a mature faith to know that. And sometimes you come to learn that more as you go along. I knew all about marriage before I got married. But marriage brings a greater maturity. Somebody once said that a marriage is two sinful people. That's what I am. I'm a sinner married to one. It is two sinful people pledging to live together with all of their faults for the rest of their lives. Isn't that it? That's what it is. And because of that, it's not perfect. Two sinful people pledging to live together with their faults for the rest of their lives. I knew all about raising kids before I had kids. I used to think that it was all over when they turned 18. You know, see you later. Now, Mom and I are going to finally have some time to ourselves. And I found out that that window is about that small. About the time you think they're gone, here they come knocking on your door again. And if it's not them coming back again, it's elderly parents that you have to care for. I remember hearing Steve Klein one time say that when his children got older, he thought, now Sandy and I are going to have a lot of time together. And he said, we had a little, but it was about that long. And then they were caring for elderly parents. I knew all about life before I actually got in the thick of it. When I was coming out of high school and out of college, I guess I thought I knew everything about life. One little funny snippet I'll leave with you. I was with Susan's daddy one day, and we were buying a U-Haul truck so that we could move from Troy, Alabama, to my very first preaching job in Anniston, Alabama. And we were debating between a 16-foot U-Haul and an 18-foot U-Haul. And Susan's daddy, just off the cuff, said, well, Jeff, how much more is 2 feet? And I said, about that much. He looked at me and he shook his head and he said, boy, he said, you got your degree. Now you need to get your education. He wasn't talking about how much is 2 feet. He wanted to know how much more does it cost for 2 more feet. But life has truly given me more of that education. God has pounded it into me more and more as time goes on. And that's just what life is. And so we're learning and we're growing, and we must focus on our duties rather than our rights. Solomon said in Ecclesiastes 12, let's hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep His commandments, for that's the whole duty of man. In Luke 17, beginning in verse 5, the apostle said, Lord, increase our faith. And the Lord said, if you have faith as a mustard seed, you can say to this mulberry tree, be pulled up by the roots and be planted in the sea, and it would obey you. And which of you, having a servant plowing or tending sheep, will say to him when he comes in from the field, come at once and sit down to eat? But will he not rather say to him, prepare something for my supper and gird yourself and serve me until I have eaten and drunk, and afterward you will eat and drink? Does he thank that servant because he did the things that were commanded him? I think not. So likewise, when you have done all of those things which you are commanded, say, we are unprofitable servants. We have done what was our duty to do. And so what we do during this time is we just continue to be faithful to our duty of living for God every day, remaining faithful and loyal and true, and realizing that God never, ever promised that it would all be hunky-dory. Now, it may be that that lesson, you're like, boy, It may be that, you know, you kind of heard that and thought, well, that's just kind of depressing. I don't know that it really is. What's depressing is when you are expecting certain things and they don't turn out that way, and then you get really, really upset. But when you know that God will be with me in all of my circumstances, it just kind of helps. I know it helps me, and I certainly hope that it will help you as well. The lesson is yours if you need to obey the gospel of Jesus Christ tonight. We're going to sing a song that will hopefully encourage you in that obedience to come to Him. And if you need to come to Him tonight, come while we stand and as we sing.